Absolutely.
Good evening. I'm opening this meeting of the Joint Committee on Student Success Subcommittee on Revenue. It's Tuesday, April 2nd. We've been through so many meetings, I even have to look down to see what day it is. This is Tuesday, April 2nd. We have an informational meeting on revenue options. Mr. Hollenack.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So overall, we have two options today, a commercial activities tax and a modified commercial activities tax. The commercial activities tax is similar to what the committee has talked about at different points throughout this session. The second one, the modified, is something that just kind of popped up last week. It was teased out a little bit on Thursday's meeting. But we have a summary description of each policy along with static impact estimates. And then we also have OTIM runs for each policy, a regular OTIM run, if you will, and the long-term run. So just walking through each of those. The commercial activities tax policy that you have tonight is a flat rate of 0.37%. It does exempt petroleum and medical provider taxes. It does apply to all entity types, so C-corps, S-corps, partnerships. At this point, it does include finance and insurance. And the way we've handled that issue is that the intent here is borrowing from the corporate excise tax, where financials and insurance companies do ultimately calculate an Oregon sales figure for the corporate excise tax. And under the commercial activities tax, they would just be pointing to that calculation, that amount of Oregon sales. The filing threshold is $150,000 in receipts for a given year. So anything under that, business wouldn't need to file. And there is a flat tax of $250 if the receipts are less than $1 million. And then the rates, so in this case, the 0.37% apply to receipts above $1 million. And that impact is then offset a bit by a reduction in the personal income tax rates. And as you can see on the table there, the current rates are 5, 7, 9, and 9.9. The adjusted rates are 4.75%, 6.75%, and 8.75%. The 9.9 has not changed. And both of these changes would take effect in 2020. And in the table below, you can see the revenue gain and revenue loss from the two policies. In the table there, so for 1921, it's just over $1.7 billion in the commercial activities tax, and then about a $300 million revenue loss from the changes in the personal income tax rates. So that nets about $1.4 billion in the 1921 biennium. And then that net impact grows to just about 2.2, and then 2.4, and then 2.6 over the subsequent biennium.
Senator Hess.
I just wanted to point out, thank you, that is around $1 billion a year, but the math won't add up in the 1921 biennium because it starts later in the two-year cycle.
Thank you. Mr. Hollenack, would you talk about that for a minute, the timing of when legislation becomes law and how the Department of Revenue starts to work?
So the implementation, and as this process progresses, this will be refined a little bit more, but with any new tax, there is a ramping up period. And from a simplistic standpoint, this starts on January 1, 2020, so we're already into the 1921 biennium. So there are 6 months that is not there in terms of collections. Each biennium afterwards does have the full 2 years of collection. So that's why it's just under the 1.7. So we get most of the tax year 2020 in that biennium, and then only part of 2021, because there's a lag in terms of when the money comes in and when people file. So there's a lag piece before it really gets into that. But the estimate for tax year 2020, as Co-Chair Haas said, was $1 billion.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So as we look at this example, one of the things that's highlighted is that we're going to exempt petroleum and medical medical provider taxpayers. And last week, I believe that was explained to us. I was curious, is there any reason why we wouldn't add other entities that have similar or like situations, such as those folks who are selling distilled spirits or beer or wine, who also are already paying commercial activity taxes on those products?
That's a good question, and those would be policy calls that the committee would make and can be discussed. This, as a starting point, it was just these two provision or two and two kinds of products or entities, if you will, that would be exempt. The idea is to start with as broad a base and lower rate as possible, going for that broad base, low rate approach.
Would it, as follow, your name, Command Co-Chair, would it be possible, and I don't know if the list is overly exhaustive, but just to see what are those commodities or services that are already subject to a form of activity tax? So that way we just have a clear understanding of what's already out there on those.
Sure, we can get the list of all.
I didn't know if it's is it pretty easy to do?
It's certainly, yeah, at some level of information. It depends. I mean, we can always make things more complicated.
Yeah, we don't need that. I just want to see the list.
But we can certainly put together a list.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that is the policy summary and the revenue impacts. And these are the kinds of numbers that would show up in a revenue impact statement. These are what we refer to the static estimates. So then we take this policy, and I'm sure this output is starting to look familiar to folks. This is our OTIM output. This is our regular, if you will. So this is CAT option one. It's those two policies, and it's put in terms of just a one-year impact, so 2020 level. So you can see the static impact right here. It's just under $1 billion, $992 million. So that's the billion-dollar impact for both policies combined. And as I've described before, creating this tax or making these tax changes creates a disequilibrium in the economy, and then the model solves, and we go from what we call our baseline to the new equilibrium. And then we look at the changes from the baseline. And the place I tend to start is the percent changes, and most of these are pretty small. And it's a fairly almost neutral impact with respect to these because the percentages are so small. I would point out, so personal income is up about $40 million. Employment is down 700 jobs. Now, I do want to emphasize, this isn't a forecasting kind of model like the state economist comes in. This is almost two sets of reality, if you will. And so it's not that 700 jobs are lost. It's that there would be a net, perhaps not as many jobs created over that time period. So it's not that, well, I'll just leave it there. And it really is those two points in time for the different tax policy structures. Population is almost unchanged. The wage index is pretty much unchanged. And then the price levels are up 0.33%. And that's pretty similar to what we've seen in other models with respect to this tax. And then one of the other aspects that people are interested in is the distribution across the households. And here, as we've seen in other regular versions of the model, our standard kind of five-year time horizon is that it's on the negative side. There's a net revenue or net household income loss across the different income categories. And so this is that model. And then to complement this model, we have what have become known as our L versions, with the L standing for long term. And this is where we take into consideration the spending side of the new revenue. And that's always something that has been a question out there in terms of how is basically spending matters, depends on how the state spends the money. And the assumption here is that the $1 billion per year all goes to education and is used wisely in that sense. And to that end, the expected result is a more productive labor force over 10, 12 years once kids in school eventually enter the labor force. And this is where some of the changes in the parameters, for example, the employment number turns from minus 700 to plus 3,700. So from on the negative side of no change to a slight positive of nearly 4,000 jobs. We can see the static impact is the same because that's the starting point. This actually has a dynamic revenue gain. The prior version had a dynamic revenue loss of $8 million. This has a dynamic revenue gain of $179 million. And the real difference can be seen in this household table where most of these turn from negative to positive. The bottom group is still largely negative because that's a group that doesn't pay much in income taxes, so they're not benefiting from the income tax cuts. Now, this is all based on this productivity parameter that we've talked about before. So what you have here is our summary and static estimates, and then the two OTIM runs that would accompany that policy.
Mr. Allenack, in conversations in previous meetings, and also with Senator Hass, we've had some discussion about this. As you just pointed out, which households benefit from a reduction in income tax owed. So I'd like for you to talk for a minute about the intent behind including these personal income tax reductions, what it does for the economy and the purpose of including these reductions. And Senator Hass, I know that you had some thoughts that you wanted to also include about how we address what may be the impact. We're looking for the impact on economic activity, not only on business, but the impact on Oregonians generally.
Sure. So the part of the change there in terms of reducing the income tax rates, that's one way to offset some of the starting point, I guess, is to offset some of the price increases. So you saw the price increase of 0.33% as businesses will, to the extent they can, shift the prices. So to offset those cost increases, you have the personal income tax cut. And then you have the question of how a personal income tax cut gets implemented. There are a lot of different ways that can happen. Where we tend to see the most response in OTIM is from rate cuts. And that tends to have the longest or the strongest labor supply response. And especially on that 9% rate. In Oregon, we hit the 9% rate pretty soon. And so most taxpayers, or nearly all taxpayers, are in that 9% bracket. So lowering the first two brackets proportionally helps lower income folks the most. They'll have relatively more of their income taxed at those brackets. But when we get into the higher income, going from the 9 to the 8.75 provides that incentive, if you will, to provide more labor. And on the business side, they can actually hire less at higher or lower wages. That's where we've seen in some of the models in the past in terms of getting at that equilibrium. Because where people respond to is their net tax, their net income, their after-tax income, their disposable household income. And so with the tax cut, it's like a pay raise that has both of those offsetting effects. And that's largely where we see the strongest labor supply response. The labor response is through the rate policies.
Thank you. Senator Hass.
Well, I would just to follow up on that, Chris, if you go to the first OTIM run, the more shorter term, and you see that everybody's a little bit in the negative there, even with that tax cut. And so that would argue for a larger tax cut, but I'm just wondering, are there other things that would sort of protect regular people from higher costs, such as an exemption for groceries, or possibly some of the things that Representative Smith mentioned? I know he's interested in beer and distilled spirits, but I was focusing on food. Like exempting groceries, what would that do to change in disposable household income, or would it have any impact at all?
I think it would have, a modest effect. I think it would have an effect, so there's value in considering that policy. for a number of reasons. In terms of the OTIM output, the relative magnitude, we're talking about $1 billion. And I think what we have in there as a base estimate for groceries, just to run with that example, is a little bit less than 10% of that. So I don't think it would dramatically change those. It would modify them just a little bit. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Chris, currently businesses are able to take the income tax they pay in Oregon and write it off on their federal income tax return. And I believe they get about 50 cents on the dollar. Under a CAT, a commercial activity tax, would a business, when they pay that, also have the option of writing that off on their federal income tax?
I would expect they would. That would also be a deduction, and it's included in some of these modeling, some of that. And that's one way some of the tax gets exported, is from the tax on businesses, and then that being a deduction on their federal taxes mm-hmm. for state and local taxes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, so moving into the second policy option, which is fairly similar. It's a modified commercial activities tax, so not too clever of a name. But we have the main difference here is the tax rate and the implementation of a deduction for business inputs or labor. So as you'll recall, the discussions that we've had over the past couple of months where we've had this continuum, if we go back to a very high level, where we have gross receipts tax with the broadest base at one end, and then at the other end, the income tax with the smallest tax base, and then the value-added tax being somewhere in the middle. This borrows from the value-added tax idea, where the starting point is gross receipts, but then there is a deduction for purchases from other businesses or labor costs. And at this point, it's still a fairly high level idea, but the concept is that businesses would calculate their costs from the inputs that they purchase from other businesses and their labor costs. And then they would get a 25% deduction equal to the greater of those two, not both of them. So they're not adding them together. It would be just one or the other. And the argument for that is, depending on the sector that the business operates in, one of those would be more preferable than the other. So I'm thinking retail, wholesale, manufacturing may want to deduct a portion of their inputs, whereas on the service sector side, deducting labor costs would be probably more beneficial. So at this point, in terms of developing or fleshing out the policy, it's just a very high-level deduction there. And there would be an apportionment piece for multi-state corporations, because you couldn't deduct this just for Oregon only, because that would likely run afoul of some interstate commerce issues. So the deduction would be calculated at a national level, and then it would have to be shared down via a single sales factor.
And to make it really clear, the business entity gets to choose which one is to their benefit.
Correct. It would be the...
I get to choose, I think.
Representative Smith Warner just offered to make the choice.
To make the choice.
That would require different modeling. but right now it's really just introducing that idea. The idea just got introduced last Thursday, and so this is taking the next step. But the way it is modeled here is the greater of the two, where the business would choose. Okay. And we have the same personal income tax cut. Now the estimated revenues are largely the same. They're a little bit different. But that was by design, where in 2020 we still get $1 billion tax increase. So how that deduction is paid for, so to speak, is that the rate goes from 0.37 to 0.45. And that's just how the mechanics will work. If the goal is $1 billion in year one, then if there's interest in pursuing this kind of deduction, the larger the deduction or the larger the exemptions, then the higher that rate needs to go.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for allowing me to ask questions. I appreciate it. So, Chris, as we look at this, and I'm looking at the chart on total real disposable household income, the final one, at the very bottom, the mean income change per household really is positive until we get down to our lowest income Oregonians. Is there a way through a policy decision that we could have kind of an opportunity, I don't know what the term would be, an opportunity tax credit to where those who are negative 89 or negative $50 could at least be zeroed out to where they're not losing money through this scenario? And what would the impact be?
Yes, Rep. Smith, that's generally how we've approached this. That bottom group has always been sticky, if you will, in terms of response here. And that's largely because they're not paying any personal income taxes, so they can't respond. There's no response there for a personal income tax cut.
Got it.
So you have property taxes, and so you can go for property tax relief, a homestead exemption or something like that, but then that only benefits property owners. It doesn't benefit the low-income renters. Mm-hmm. And at different points over the years, we have explored some kind of other tax credit, refundable tax credit. Now, for folks at that bottom end to benefit even from the tax credit, we can put that in our models as showing a benefit. But the logistical challenge there is you're having people who probably aren't filing taxes. Now, they can still file a tax return to get a refundable credit. We see that with the earned income tax credit, for example, under current law. So there are some things we can do. The cost of it, it can be crafted so that it focuses just on the lowest income. But there are, we haven't found a silver bullet so far in the various policy options that we've looked at over several years. But there are some things we can explore.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, the reason I raised that issue is going back to Senator Bence's thoughts last week about some of our vulnerable senior citizens and others in need. So I just raised that issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Haas?
Yes, I was just going to say we've seen that category on different taxes come up a lot. And really what you want to do, if what you're talking about to help this population really isn't anything in the tax code, it's housing, you know, homeless services, you know, free health care or those kinds of programs, not really taxes.
Got it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But if you were, I just want to reinforce the earned income tax credit because it's refundable, it can be targeted to specifically hit that population. So that is another option too. So, but I'd take free health care also.
Well, if I may, Madam Chair, the problem with the earned income tax credit is you have to earn income to get the tax credit, and a lot of these people are not working or filing taxes.
Well, I kind of jumped ahead to that last.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Let's see if I can figure out how to work the mouse. So I think those are all those pieces. And again, the static revenue impacts are very similar to the first one by design. The two levers, the tax rate increases to pay for the deduction. And then we get to the OTIM output. So the first one is our regular five-year horizon, so MCAT option two. And it's again very similar to the first one, which I think makes a lot of sense because we're basically shrinking the tax base by the deduction, but then having a higher tax rate. So those mechanics will work out to be fairly similar in terms of economic responses. And that's what we see here. The employment one is a popular one. That's minus 800 instead of 700. And the price levels are up the same, 0.33. And then the disposable income, the distribution here is again negative throughout the nine groups under the five-year modeling, and then if we bounce down to the long term where it makes certain assumptions about the spending, then most of these groups are either made whole or have a positive response, except for that bottom group, and which was again very similar to the first set of the first policy output.
Senator Bence.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Christy, can you point out in this chart where you factored in the return on the education investment? Does it show up anyplace?
There is a there's a parameter. It doesn't specifically show up. I can't point on the table. It's on the spending side. Now, as we've discussed before in OTIM, the spending side isn't that elaborate. We basically have four sectors of spending, state and local, and then education, non-education. But we do have what I refer to as a return to it's a productivity parameter where we need to make some assumptions about the effectiveness of spending. And I'm really just turning it on or off. There's not a way to fine tune it, or there isn't a lot of academic direction on where to set that parameter. And when OTIM was built, there were a variety of groups put together to provide their professional opinions on what some of these parameters should be. And this is one that we have set that's basically turned to neutral most of the time, basically thinking that any tax change, then the state will be doing more of what it usually does, just kind of more of the same. So it's turned off, if you will. For the past several years, I think going on 10, there's been a lot of interest on the spending side in the argument that how the state spends the money matters. And we have this productivity parameter that was built into the structure of OTIM back when it was constructed in 2000 that we're basically turning on. And it's not very detailed in that I can't show exactly where it lands in one of these outputs. But that's why we're having the complementary output, so it's clear when that's being turned on or not.
A follow-up. Mm-hmm. Thank you. The question then is, how long does it take to kick in? 5 years, 10 years, 50 years?
That's a very good question. And there isn't, again, I have to go back to this is where we don't have a lot of guidance. So under the assumptions we've used for the basic OTIM, we've had this 5-year time horizon. And that is in part by assumption. The model itself, we start with this assumption that the economy is in equilibrium, we make these changes, the model solves, and now we're at equilibrium again. And that's holding everything else constant. And keeping in mind that regardless of how complicated these models can be, they're still very simplistic versions of reality. So we still have to hold everything else constant. And that's where we've used this 5-year time horizon. So now when we turn this productivity parameter on, there isn't a whole lot of guidance to say exactly, oh, this is now at the 7-year version or the 12-year version or the 15-year version. And that's why I just have it as an L. But basically, we're kind of thinking, you know, maybe 10 or 12 years, but it's not this is more of the art than the science piece of this.
Another topic, Madam Chair, when
yes.
there's a chance. On the stacking part of this, and to build on the question Representative Smith asked about the deductibility of that which people pay at the very bottom of the or the top of the stack, whichever one's paying the most, how much did they deduct? The tax they pay is still the same rate, but the amount they pay overall is considerably higher because they're paying the entire stacked up amount. Can you clear up my thinking on that? The tax rate doesn't go up. It's just that each layer of production has the tax added to it. So they're not going to get to deduct, unless they had a cost of goods device, the amount that was added from the let's take 4 levels.
So the pyramiding piece.
Yeah, the pyramiding.
So in terms of what they would deduct off their federal return, it would be the tax, the bottom line tax.
Yeah.
In terms of... So I think there are a couple of questions embedded in that.
At least.
So you have the tax that they would deduct would be, you know, they write the check to the Department of Revenue for $1,000 or whatever it is, and then that's the tax that they deduct off the federal level. In terms of the ultimate pyramiding that might hit the consumers, that gets embedded in each layer, whether it's 2 layers or 4 layers. And there it depends on how each business responds to this. Keeping in mind that there's an exemption of $1 million for each business. And I provided an example a few weeks ago where, depending on the nature of the business, they sometimes pay the tax or not. But the extent to which a business can pass that cost forward, they will. And to the extent that they can't, they won't be able to. And that'll depend on the individual markets that the businesses are facing. If you have somebody who has 10% of their business in Oregon and 90% of their business outside of Oregon, they might be able to export some of that tax depending on those markets and how those businesses will respond. But at the bottom line, the best that we have for this kind of stacking is this input-output matrix, the core structure of the model. and that gets embedded in that price level piece at the end of the day. That's the best estimate we have for the change.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. In 2009, when the legislature looked at increasing the corporate income tax, one of the areas that we forgot to address was cooperatives as that operate under corporations. And then, so I'm hoping that we'll be able at some point in time to have a conversation to provide surety to both our nonprofit corporations and our cooperatives, whether they're electric cooperatives or grain cooperatives or whatever they may be, they're very diverse, that we would have a mechanism to protect them in one way or another, or at least be able to have a conversation about the impact this would have on them.
As it, where we're the modeling so far in the estimates right now, for at least with respect to the nonprofit sector, those aren't included. So this is just the for-profit sector. The issue, as I recall, around the cooperatives was that ag products that were grown and produced in Oregon ultimately were going overseas, but they stopped, so to speak. They went from the farm on, say, Eastern Oregon and went to a warehouse, for example, in Portland, and then went. So they weren't really Oregon sales. And so that was one of the things to make sure that it was defined as, so this isn't the final destination, this is just a stop before it gets shipped overseas. Yeah.
That was an important consideration. Mm-hmm. And there's a fix for that.
You have finished going through.
Yes, that was the output that I have. We have the third. I think six pages. We have two models. We have the summary and static estimates and the two versions of the OTIM for each of the two policies. And that was the sum total of what I had prepared this evening.
And there are a few specific discrete issues that have been raised by this subcommittee. Senator Haas.
I was just going to ask, Chris, and I don't mean to put you on the spot with this question, but when you look at kind of the clean version and then the hybrid version, what is your takeaway of that hybrid version in terms of its viability?
It seems, in terms of what OTIM is telling us so far, is that the economic response or outcome is going to be fairly similar. So it seems like the modified version would be certainly doable. The question there is really the optics of, you have the rate, and to the extent that might affect any sort of pyramiding or stacking, but then it's being paid for with a higher rate on other items. The subtraction for the different industry, at least the way I'm thinking about it now, seems to be a decent policy to confront some of those issues. I think the question there is, how big should that, if the committee so chooses to go with some sort of deduction, how big should it be in concert with the rate, because you have both of those playing,
right,
playing against each other.
Bigger deduction, the higher the rate.
All right.
One of the important takeaways for me tonight in looking at the OTIM models, the regular versus the L version, I guess you might say, is that it matters what you're spending the money on. This conversation isn't just about a tax. We're a revenue subcommittee, and it's our charge to talk about how we would raise some additional money. But the point is, it's an investment, and this investment is in education. And apparently, this becomes very obvious when you're comparing the models.
And that's the one of the criticisms. I mean, when OTIM was first getting used in the odd years after 2001, that spending side hadn't really been flushed out. And then over the past, I think Measure 66 and 67 might have been the first time we really started exploring this productivity parameter as one way of at least addressing the issue of how spending matters. Because there are plenty of ways the state can spend money, or the way the money could be spent, that arguably would be different. It wouldn't have the intended and desired effect of basically enhancing the human capital in Oregon. So to that investment piece, this $1 billion a year goes to education. We assume it's spent well, it's allocated well, and it actually improves the human capital. Now that's a lot of assumptions to ask of OTIM, but.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So if, thank you. What you're saying, of course, is if we raised $1 billion a year and the money went to the state to pay people to dig holes and then fill up the holes the next day, then this would look much different on the long-term model?
It gets very hard under that spending plan. It gets really hard to argue that the L version would make any sense.
Okay.
How are you going to get rid of that amendment?
Precisely because there wouldn't be any long-term impact on human capital.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question is how much, and I don't want to use the, I want to hope that however this body chooses to invest the money, if not in education, would be better than digging the holes and filling them up. Let's assume it. What is the difference in, is it, well, we saw it in the first chart, is that a good place to focus when we're trying to say if we don't place this into education, this is the hit the economy will take?
The first version would be the state taking the money and doing more of the same. So nothing, no, there's no change in direction for the state. We're just going to be doing more of the same. The L version is the assumption that with this new revenue source, precisely the opposite, that the state is going to do something different with respect to spending. And in this case, it's going into human capital, education.
You follow up. And I'm looking at your chart, and it looks as though the difference was 0.2%. And if we just invested it as we normally do, and how much of a gain was there? So would we add the two together to figure out what that difference is? If we go down to your next one and where you actually assume education, and you have an increase of 0.4, so is it a 0.6% swing?
Which statistic are you?
I'm looking at your different percentage difference in the first hypothetical and comparing, and then going down to the second and assuming the education piece is factored in, it looks like the difference is 0.4%. I added that to your negative two to suggest that you had a 0.6% overall difference in how you resulting.
Yeah, I think that's, I'd have to think about adding whether it's purely additive, but it's probably.
Madam Chair, this gets me to my remark, which was if this body chose, and I'm not sure who actually chooses, to dedicate this money as we do road taxes to student success, so that forevermore this money goes to student success. I don't like dedicated taxes for many, all kinds of reasons, but I was trying to get a understanding of what difference it would make. According to the OTIM model, it looks like 0.6%, at least as to those above 205,000. Work our way down for the rest.
Yeah, that's for that top income group. Another way to look at that is, so here is the modified one, and we have the static impact of $1 billion, and it has a dynamic revenue loss of about $10 million. And as far as the dynamic revenue impacts, that's often an opposite sign of the static impact, whether we model a straight up tax increase or a straight up tax decrease. It's a mitigating force. It's offsetting, basically saying that the response to the tax increase or tax cut will work in a slightly opposite direction. Now, with this product under the L version, and again, it has those same caveats, that dynamic effect now goes from the minus 10 to plus 179. And that is embedded in this assumption of a more productive workforce. Mm-hmm. And the more productive workforce leading to higher wages and higher incomes.
I may, Madam Chair. Of course, so the cost of avoiding the dedicated fund would be you'd place those two numbers together, I guess, and that would give you the cost of abandoning your dedication to education at some unknown point in the future.
Right, with all of the, yeah.
Anything else tonight? We've completed reviewing this revenue option. Senator Hess, anything to add?
No, I think we're getting close to winnowing these downs, winnowing these selections, and I think we're getting close.
Thank you all. Meeting is adjourned.